welcome to the program. This is the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is James Petras. Jim, there's so much going on. Certainly Gaza is an issue that concerns us greatly. The Ukraine situation, Obama waging Iraq War number 3. Let me let you jump in and discuss whatever issue you want to get into to begin the program.
Well, I think the first thing to note, Steve, is the subsequent action of Israel following the latest ceasefire confirms your evaluation that any agreement with Israel is absolutely worth less than used toilet paper. They launched a series of bombings 30 minutes after the ceasefire was supposed to start, and the latest reports I've got this morning is that they're mobilizing thousands of reservists armed and backed by armored carriers on the borders with Gaza, which suggests that they're ready for another massive invasion. So this ceasefire that's been hailed as such a big breakthrough seems to me extraordinarily precarious and simply preparing the ground for a sneak attack by Israel, which will further destroy Gaza, and perhaps it's aimed at destroying and undermining any possibility of a any kind of a lasting settlement.
Jim, I agree with you entirely. I wrote a short article. Usually my articles are a little longer than this particular one, and I'll get this out later today. But the title of the article I will send you later is called Sham Cairo Talks Continue. I think it's a sick joke, Jim. The basic rights that the Palestinians want, they absolutely won't get. Israel won't give it to them. Washington supports Israel 100%. Washington doesn't give a damn about Palestinian rights. And the notion that anything positive for the Palestinians, for the Gazans, or the Palestinians throughout the territories will come out of these talks is pure fantasy, in my opinion. And why the Palestinian negotiators agreed to extend this thing for 5 days, I could see 24 hours, 48 hours, 5 days, to come up with absolutely nothing, which is how these things will end. This thing will end. I just don't understand why they did that.
Well, the reason it won't end, Steve, is because Israel doesn't want any Palestinians, any Arabs, whether they're Muslims, Christians, atheists, or what have you, to exist. That is to say, this isn't the kind of negotiations to come to an agreement with another people. The invasion is designed to destroy any living possibilities for the Gazans, force them to abandon the country so that Israel can create a state only for Jews, by Jews, without any other possible population existing there. And if you have an adversary that looks toward exterminating and expelling the population, there's no basis for seeing any kind of solution, whether it's short-term or long-term. The Palestinian demands, which are hidden behind a lot of the propaganda which in the U.S., they simply want to end a blockade. They want to be able they want the free circulation of people and goods like any normal country. They want to be able, the fishermen, to go offshore and fish. They want to have an airport. They want to have a highway system that allows them to transport goods and services. They want to have shipping, air, and land transportation that allows them to link up their economy with the rest of the world. And Israel doesn't allow that, and that's what this conflict is all about. They don't want to allow the free circulation because they want the Palestinians completely expelled from what was their historical homeland.
They sure do, Jim, except maybe numbers they can use is basically cheaper or serf or slave labor. They do need some of that, pick the oranges or whatever, and do some of the dirty work that the Jewish population would prefer not to do. But other than that, they don't want the Palestinians, and they certainly won't give them the fundamental rights they deserve. And this is the outrage about the whole thing. And it's been the history of Israel-Palestinian relations, Jim, since going back to the 1947-48 war. There was a genocidal war, and then other genocidal wars followed. And again, the notion that anything good is going to come out of this for the Palestinian people, whether it's the Gazans or whether the Palestinians throughout the territory, let alone the diaspora ones who Israel absolutely will never allow to return, I say it's pure fantasy. So we've got these talks, I consider sham talks, going on, and we'll see what will happen. I think there'll be something that'll be put down on paper, Jim, something that's called an agreement, but Israel notoriously violates the agreement, and the one that they agreed to after Operation Pillar of Cloud, in November 2012, literally straight away, Israel began violating the terms, which included open borders and free movement of people and goods, and multiple violations occurred daily. So the idea that Israel will agree to something and then follow through on it, again, it simply won't happen.
Yes, and what has this Gaza massacre, genocide, has one positive feature, and that is it's enlightened hundreds of millions of people. And for the first time, I can honestly say that your views and my views of Israel now correspond to the mainstream of world public opinion. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to change things, because at the top, the governments are still supporting Israel. You see, the United States Congress approved $225 million even before going on vacation. They wouldn't discuss crisis issues in America. They wouldn't discuss the 52,000 children stranded in detention camps and on the borders. But they certainly jumped to their hind feet when the Israeli lobby in Washington told them, look, we're depleting our rockets. We blasted so many houses and hospitals that we need a new supply of missiles. So don't go on vacation until you vote another couple hundred million dollars for Israel. And I think the issue is this. What makes these governments act despite majority public opinion that is opposed to it? Now, I'm not saying that every American or majority of Americans are pushing for an alternative agenda, but the views, especially young people under 30, is overwhelmingly sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians today. And I think anything that talks to change has to begin here in the United States. And I think that's the key. And fighting in the United States is influencing Congress and the president. In order to influence Congress and the president, we have to recognize who are the major forces that are pressuring and influencing and buying these congressional votes that are propping up and arming Israel. And that is the pro-Israel lobby, the 52 major American Jewish organizations. And this is something that some of the critics are not willing to confront. They talk about Washington. Yes, Washington is the trigger. But who are the intellectual and political backers of Washington? That has to be fought. We're not going to stop the slaughter in Gaza or Palestine or Israel unless we take on the pro-Israel lobby. And that's what people like Noam Chomsky, Amy Goodman, etc., absolutely refuse to mention when they are criticizing the policies in Gaza. And I think that is a major distraction. You cannot win the fight in America until you identify the power configurations that make U.S. policy.
Well, Jim, you certainly covered that so superbly in your book, that I wrote a review on a good number of years ago, the power of Israel in the United States. Have I got the title exactly right? It's been so long.
Exactly right, Steve.
The power of Israel in the United States, and the fact that the lobby is more than just AIPAC or the Zionist Organization of America and the other 50, but it goes deep into the grassroots of communities with doctors, lawyers, other professionals, ordinary people, and the influence these people to be agents of Israel, effectively lobbying for the benefit of Israel against the interests of America and goodwill and peace and so on and so forth, and this thing is a powerful instrument for having all of these wrongs just get committed over and over again.
Steve, on every level. It's intimidating people at the national level, at the professional level, at the universities and the hospitals, and in the families. I know several critics of Israel who are attacked by their own family members and at their family gatherings. I have to be silent because they're afraid that their relatives will jump up and denounce them. And I think this is what it's face-to-face as well as the impersonal power that is so potent and the capacity to punish people. Film actors that criticize get blacklisted by producers. Radio reporters, we've seen several of them in Gaza that were recalled, etc. I think this is a full-scale battle that takes place. And no, we're talking about less than 1% of the population. Many of them are in strategic positions, and they have aggressive, active militants who are willing to take on everybody and anybody, including their own kinships.
Well, it's absolutely true, Jim. We're a little bit older. I can remember growing up. I was 14 years old when Israel became a nation, and I never one time remember a discussion of Israel in my household between my parents or mentioning it to me in any way. But it was a different world back then. Israel was brand new, and I knew, even at age 14, I knew nothing about the horrors that went on in Israel's so-called War of Independence, the mass slaughter of Palestinians, the raping of women, the other atrocities that were committed, the mass displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who never got the right to come home again. And this stuff went on. And, of course, the wars that followed, so many others, 1967 June, the Six-Day War, the popular narrative is that Israel was defending itself against hordes of Arabs, like in 1947-48. And the truth was that Israel's War of Independence was a walkover because the Arab troops were small and really not very interested in fighting a war, and so Israel literally walked over and won their war easily. And in 1967, I quoted Israeli commander saying that they ate and slept the planning of this campaign. It had nothing to do with a threat against Israel. It had everything to do with naked Israeli aggression. And except for the 1973 Yom Kippur War, all of these wars and all of this violence was initiated by Israel. Naked aggression and every single attack on the Palestinian people of any substance, it's Israeli aggression wrongfully blamed on Hamas or somebody else. And when Hamas or another resistance group responds in self-defense, it's called terrorism.
Well, you mentioned terrorism, Steve, but it's not only abroad. We have terrorism in black neighborhoods all over the United States. The latest incident, the shooting of the young unarmed teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis, and the subsequent savage response of the SWAT teams to black protesters last night using rubber bullets, tear gas bombs, and clubs to quell a reasonably quiet, peaceful demonstration. And then earlier in the evening, the shooting of another black man in Los Angeles. This is a scourge. Terrorism not only exists abroad, but we have it right here, and it's paid with taxpayers' dollars. There's no way that these trigger-happy police get punished. There's no systematic review of community police relations and attempt to bring the police into serving the people instead of shooting and bludgeoning them. And the arbitrariness and the impunity with which the police operate, it's not simply the local loose cannon on the police force. It's a systemic problem. It's the structure of relationships between oppressed people and the state that's at the base of this. And Obama is presiding over this police state, and all he can say when a young teenager is shot is cool it. I mean, who's he kidding? He knows as well as we do that the police have complete impunity and that he has presided over the killing of as many black young people as any president preceding him.
Indeed, indeed. And the notion that America has put racism in its past, Jim, again, is pure fantasy. I mean, there's racism all over the place in my own city of Chicago. It's astonishing just the horrors that go on in this city. And when we see reports about a white kid getting hurt or maybe a black shooting a white, this might make headlines. But in a city like Chicago on a typical weekend, especially in the summer when the weather is warm, you can find half a dozen murders of black youths, and it doesn't even get a mention in the news. So who gives a damn about black kids getting shot or police violence? I read a book years ago about police repression in America, and it called Chicago the police repression capital of America. Well, I mean, it's pretty bad in lots of places, New York, L.A., small towns, as well as large cities, but racism is a part of life in America. There's no question about that, and the cops think they have license to go out and kill black kids with impunity. And what do? They give them death duty, Jim. They don't prosecute them and put them in prison for murder. They put them on death duty.
Yes, and that's a serious problem. I think the grievance is accumulating, Steve. In New York State, where I'm living, they're closing down hospitals, particularly in poor areas, which are predominantly minorities, Latinos and blacks. They're closing down schools. Here in upstate New York, over 70% of the kids in some of the schools have to get a food subsidy. You get a free lunch, and some of them get free breakfast as well as lunch. They march in. They're very quiet. You know how young kids are. Well, when they're going for their probably their only or second meal of the day, they march in as disciplined soldiers, looking forward with a hungry eye at the plates that they're going to try to fill before the school bell rings them into classes. These problems of poverty, hunger, school closings and crowdings, closing of hospitals, people have to wait 5 and 6 hours in not very healthy emergency rooms where infections are predominant. I just read today in Massachusetts, supposedly a very advanced state, the hospitals are full of infectious diseases, and these are, they affect all people, but you can imagine what the conditions are in the emergency room. So what happens when they shoot a young person like that? It's a trigger that brings all the hostilities for the deprivations and exploitation to the surface. It's under the surface now when you're crowded in. Your kid goes to a school with 40 other kids. They can't be fed. Then you're sick. You take them to the hospital. You lose a day of work. These are all the grievances and aggravations that precipitate people finally saying, you know, basta, that's enough. We're going out in the streets. And they go out in the streets and protest, and they shoot rubber bullets that can take your eye out.
Oh, boy, they sure can hurt you. There's no question about that. Of course, we had lots of eruptions in the 1960s. I just wonder how long persecuted people will sit back and take these kinds of abuses.
Well, clearly in Ferguson, Missouri, they're not taking it. This is several days now of people out in the streets,
yes.
Young people, etc. And the media focus on a few vandalism incidents, a car burning here, a store window breaking there. But what about the hearts that are broken of the young people who were injured in the protests? What about the young person who was preparing to go to college who ended up in the morgue? These are the big picture. And, you know, all these investigations are ploys to simply get people out of the streets. And then they have a blue ribbon committee. They prepare a report. They talk about undue force. They talk about educating the police. But they've been educating the police now for 50 years, and it hasn't made any difference. It's not a question of education. It's a question of power. The organization of the police is such it's independent of any citizen control.
Well, it sure is, Jim. It hasn't changed a bit over the years. And again, when cops know they can get away with murder, and the only thing that would happen to them might be a short suspension or something or other, this stuff will continue. And it's not a big city issue. It's a national issue. There's nothing done at the federal level, state or local level, and these kind of abuses go on. And the vulnerable people of color, mainly blacks, Latinos, they're the ones so badly affected. And whether it's violence or simply denying their basic rights, like immigrants that are treated so poorly. I mean, this stuff goes on. And the notion of thinking that America is a wonderful democratic state, when it treats its most vulnerable people so abusively, that pretty much sums up the state of things in America.
Well, Steve, let's shift the last part of our discussion to the Ukraine. I like some of your comments are very well taken. And the question is that there is as much of a slaughter in the Ukraine by the U.S.-backed regime in Kiev as there is of any crimes committed in the Iraq by ISIS. If we look at comparably the bombing of populated cities in Donetsk and eastern Ukraine are comparable to any crimes that are committed by Islamic terrorist groups. And yet we're told that the U.S. is intervening for humanitarian purposes, which is the usual ploy to get the U.S. military feet on the ground again. But look at the Ukraine, where today's news, the BBC talks about shelling. No, it's not shells. There are bombs on highly densely populated city centers that are killing and maiming people and blowing up housing. They cut off electricity, water, gas. These are cities. It's as bad as it was in Stalingrad when the Nazis were invading Russia. And I think this is one of the great crimes of the current period, along with the other crimes that we can enumerate. The Ukraine is under siege by fascists who are recruited as the shock troops of the Ukrainian government.
Well, there's no question about that, Jim. And the main article I'm working on today is called Blocking Russian Humanitarian Aid. Russia is legitimately trying to supply real humanitarian aid, food, water, medical supplies, other things that desperate people need. And the Ukrainian government, fully supported by Washington, is calling this a pretense for a Russian invasion and stuff like that. It's outrageous. And the major media here don't explain the things properly. They basically go along with the party line and proliferate these really disgraceful lies about what's going on. And ordinary people in the line of fire, it really is like Stalingrad to a great extent. And how this thing is going to end, I mean, people are dying. In the article I'm writing, the UN estimates that on average about 70 casualties a day, deaths and injuries, and it keeps increasing. It was 60 until the beginning of August. Now it's 70. Will it go up to 80? Will it go up to 100? I mean, these are ordinary men, women, and children, and they're getting massacred by the fascists that are running things in Ukraine, the people of Washington put into power, infested by neo-Nazis.
Yes, Steve, and the issue is that the Russians have been acting very, very moderately in this context. The Europeans joining the U.S. prodded them to support these sanctions. Now they're boomeranging. Europe, I'm writing a paper now, Europe is in a deep crisis. Finland has been in negative growth for the last 4 years. We won't speak of Spain, Portugal, and Greece, where unemployment is in the 20-25% range. We can talk about Germany now because of the sanctions and other insecurity. Nobody in Germany wants to invest. Germany is heading into a recession. The crisis in Europe is exacerbated by this. They don't need less trade. They need more trade. And the countries that export fruit and vegetables are already cut off. And they got the begging cup going to Latin America and asking the Latin Americans not to take their markets. And President of Ecuador told them to shove it. He says, don't tell us who we're going to trade with. We're going to double our sales of bananas to Russia. The same goes in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile. It's going to be a failure. They're going to lose the agricultural markets in Russia. And their leaders can go and ask Mr. Obama to buy more apples when we have more apples in upstate New York than all the Poles and other exporters want to sell us. And I think I say to the Poles, eat your apples now that you want to get involved in confronting Russia.
Oh, indeed, Jim. We're getting near the end of the program. Maybe I can just wrap it up by saying, I mean, the sanctions are absolutely ridiculous and counterproductive. And the notion that you're going to hurt Russia can strike back and hurt plenty. They could cut off gas supplies to every European country that's imposing sanctions on them. I mean, that and certainly to Ukraine. This tit-for-tat stuff is crazy. And European business in Germany and in England and France, business are absolutely furious with the government that they're playing these kind of sick games that are hurting business. And you're right, Jim. I think we're heading into a recession there, and it could hit a U.S. trade is much less, but there could be trouble here as well. Jim, I'll wrap it up, and I say I look forward to getting you back for another great show. The time goes by much too fast. These issues are not going away soon by any means.
Okay, thanks for inviting me, Stephen. It's good to hear your robust voice again.
It's great to be back, Jim. It really is great to be
back. I'm glad.
I wanted to
fight
over the
worst,
one time.
Steve.
Thank you, Jim.
Right, bye.